and the idea of air purification and disinfection was common to them all, while houses decorated with flowers and greenery are also better known at other times of the year, so midsummer again is the poor relation. One custom specific to the day, however, was the making of midsummer cushions, which was recorded in the 18th and 19th centuries in Northumberland, Durham, and by the Northamptonshire poet John Clare. The custom involved smearing damp clay on top of a stool or other suitable surface and decorating it by pressing flowers and greenery into it, like a small-scale fusion of a May Day garland with a well dressing. These cushions were displayed outside people's doors, sometimes simply to delight the neighbours, but sometimes to raise money from them. John Clare called one of his collections of poems the Midsummer Cushion, and the custom has been revived in Helpston, where he lived. A number of other customs which were not specific to midsummer took place across the midsummer months, such as well dressing.
We started on the dressing on Monday, and it takes a full week of back-breaking work. We put clay in, and then we have to prick it all out, petal it all.
Well, what kind of size are we talking about? What's the scale of it?
6 foot by 7.
Jackie, I believe you're the artist.
I am, yeah.
What is the design this year?
It's the Bull's Head, the local pub. The theme is our village for every year, so it's nice to have a, you know, something different in the village.
Yeah. Continuing a tradition, really, aren't
that's
we?
Right.
That's yeah. Yes. Gone in Derbyshire yeah. for many, many years. It's about giving thanks for the water, and these villages all depended on the wells for the water.
There's a real skill in how you put the petals and the stones and the slate and so on onto the clay to make the picture. And also with the petals, you have to make quite sure they're going in the right direction, because when it's standing upright, the water's got to run down the petals. You can't have the water collecting in the flowers because it'll spoil the picture during the week.
There's an art to petaling.
Mm-hmm. Do you consider yourself a petaling artist? OK, I'm standing in front of the well-dressing now. I can see now that there is a lot of craft involved in this. So this is all into clay, is it? These are all individually pressed into clay?
Yes.
Every single, every petal, everything is individually pressed in. So this is chamomile's, all the hydrangea petals and the chrysanthemum petals.
We've got a bit of slate there.
Yes.
That's cheating, isn't it?
No, because it's natural. Everything
right,
has
okay.
to be natural.
I'm with you.
Even glass in the lanterns is natural because it's made from sand.
Right, okay.
And these are peppercorns.
Oh,
peppercorns.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
These are leaves, just leaves. These are eggshells.
The women of Tinswell in Derbyshire dressing their well in June 2010. Another custom is rush-bearing, a remnant of the days when the churches had earth floors strewn with layers of rushes which had to be changed periodically. And in many places, the practical necessity evolved into a symbolic and celebratory custom, which continued long after the real need was passed. In many places, it was a relatively restrained affair, with women and children in special costume coming on a specific day with small quantities of rushes, or with rushes woven into symbolic shapes which were used to decorate the church. And this still continues in a few places in the Lake District, such as Grasmere, each July.
Marks this annual rush bearing, a traditional festival where the rushes were taken to the church, but a time to celebrate all that is good about our community's life. So we're going to sing the rush bearing hymn.
In other places, however, the custom was far more robust, with specially decorated cartloads of rushes brought to the church in grand procession with music, drums and Morris dancers. Ah yes, Morris dancing, one of the most widespread symbols of an English summer scene, and it is in fact one of our oldest surviving customs, dating back at least 500 years. There are 9 references to the dance in the second half of the 15th century, with the earliest being in 1448. And it is interesting to note that some of these refer to fine art representations of a Morris dancer, which demonstrates that the character was already sufficiently well known at the time for people to make figures of him. Most people think of the Morris as a Whitsun or May Day custom, but it was clearly popular throughout the summer months, and some authorities refer specifically to midsummer appearances. Nor was it exclusively a rural custom, as there are regular references to Morris men in city processions. The jury is still out on why they are called Morris dances, although the most likely derivation is from Moorish, i.e. from Morocco or North Africa. But even if this is true, it's still not clear whether the dance came from that region or was thought to be like what the Moors do. Many present-day Morris dancers think that the North African connection is correct, and the musician Kerry Rees-Matthews thinks that he has some evidence for this.
In 2002, I was asked by the British Council if I'd like to go to North Africa, to Libya, with a little bagpipe group that I had. They'd sort of lined us up to meet some Berber pipers in particular, and it was all based around a festival way out in the, well, it seemed like to me like it was way out in the desert, and there was groups of musicians from all over North and West Africa. The makeup of our group was three of us are from Swansea and one of us was from Middlesbrough. A Morris dancer, he's quite a gruff personality, you know, I can't really tell you exactly what he said when one of the groups came on, but he said, beep, 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 they're bloody Morris dancers. What we saw was a group of six men coming on dressed in white with two ribbons diagonally across their chest with a boss in the middle of it, doing steps that he sort of recognised. There was really, there they were, doing it, it has to be said, very, very daintily.
Not everybody was pleased to see the Morris men in the old days. Philip Stubbs is the most famous spokesman for the Puritan Brigade, and he complained in his Anatomy of Abuses of 1583.
They bedeck themselves with scarves, ribbons and laces, hanged all over with golden rings, precious stones and jewels. This done, they tie about either leg 20 or 40 bells, with rich handkerchiefs in their hands and laid across their shoulders and necks, borrowed for the most part of their mopsies or loving bessies for bussing them in the dark. Thus all things set in order. Then have they their hobby horses, their dragons and other antiques, together with their bawdy pipers and thundering drummers to strike up the devil's dance with all. Then march this heathen company towards the church and churchyard, their pipers piping and their drummers thundering, their stumps dancing, their bells ringing, their handkerchiefs fluttering about their heads like madmen, their hobby horses and other monsters skirmishing amongst the throng.
Modern-day folk trying to enjoy a quiet pint in a country pub might have a similar reaction when the Morris men arrive. But was there no supernatural side to Midsummer? Again, the period suffers from being overshadowed by other times. The instances of customs recorded on Midsummer's Day are nearly always isolated examples of beliefs which were far more associated with other days in the year, such as porch watching and love divination. Porch watching was mostly associated with St. Mark's Eve on the 24th of April, but is occasionally reported as a Midsummer Eve custom. Details vary from place to place, but the basic idea is if you stand in the church porch at midnight, you will see the wraiths of all the parishioners processing into the church. Those who will survive the coming year will return after a short time, and those who will get married will appear arm in arm. But anyone who is to die during the year will not come out at all. This was reported as a belief across the country from 1608 to the mid-19th century, although how many people really tried it is anybody's guess. But by far the most commonly reported forms of divination have always been concerned with love rather than death, and there are countless ways of finding out who your future husband or wife will be. These range from the very simple wedding cake under the pillow kind of thing, where you will dream of your future partner, to more scary procedures designed to show him in the mirror looking over your shoulder or to conjure up his wraith to visit you. And there are more sinister ones which force him to love you, often the last resort of someone who has been dumped. John Aubrey, author of Brief Lives, recorded a simple procedure in the 1680s, which was specific to Midsummer.
I remember the maids, especially the cookmaids and dairymaids, would stick up in some chinks of the joists, etc., Midsummer men, which are slips of orpins. They place them by pairs, one for such a man and the other for such a maid his sweetheart, and accordingly as the Orpin did incline to or recline from the other, that there would be love, or aversion, or, if either did wither, death.
300 years later, the custom was still going strong, as recorded by Jacqueline Simpson in her book The Folklore of Sussex. There is also the making of the dumb cake, often specifically on Midsummer Eve. A group of girls must get together at midnight and, without saying a single word throughout the process, prepare and bake a cake and set it on the table. Their future husbands will appear to share it with them. In addition to the rule of silence, there are many other strictures to test the girls' resolve, such as the ingredients, salt, soot, and their own urine. But it is in plant lore that we get the closest connection between Midsummer and the supernatural. Midsummer Men, for the purple-flowered Orpin, is not the only example of a popular plant named after the day. Midsummer Day is the feast of St. John the Baptist, and St. John's wort, or hypericum, much beloved by modern herbalists, has long had a reputation for being efficacious in the supernatural as well as the medicinal sphere. Across Britain and Ireland, the plant was believed to be highly effective for a wide range of ailments, including poison, catarrh, hair loss, cuts and sprains, and worn about the person, it wards off the evil eye, counters the machinations of fairies and demons, and hung up in the house, guards against fires and lightning strikes. It also promotes general prosperity and good fortune. So Shakespeare was right. Midsummer can be a time of dreams, marriage and magic after all.
Now it is the time of night, that the graves all gaping wide, in the churchway paths to glide. And we fairies that do run by the triple Hecate's team, from the presence of the sun, following darkness like a dream, now our frolic. Not a mouse shall disturb this hallowed house. I am sent with broom before to sweep the dust behind the door.
Puck, tidying up towards the end of A Midsummer Night's Dream. The reader was Joel McCormack, and What Visions Have I Seen was presented by Steve Rowd and produced by Julian May. Welcome back for the third part of this evening's BBC Prom, live on BBC Radio 3, home of the proms. I'm Andrew McGregor, here at the Royal Albert Hall, where Shakespeare's play has been a magical influence all evening. We're about to witness the final flowering of Sir Michael Tippett's The Midsummer Marriage and an explosion of musical invention in the third act, evoking midnight fire, carnal desire, a giant flower, sorry, one too many rhymes, and a clairvoyant with a vision of sexual consummation that's not at all to the liking of the father of the bride. You can follow reactions to the opera on Twitter, hashtag BBC Proms, and if you've missed any of it, don't forget to catch up online with the BBC's iPlayer Radio anytime over the next week. Well, as the promenaders tell us the financial news this evening, the BBC Symphony Orchestra, singers and symphony chorus are about to be conducted by one of Tippett's greatest living fans, Sir Andrew Davis, and he obviously enjoys the Mozartian archetypes that inspired the opera.
Clearly, the magic flute is an antecedent of the piece, as I suppose is Frauen Schatten of Strauss, inasmuch as it's, we've got the two pairs of lovers, Tamino, Pamina, of course, Mark and Jennifer, and then the Papageno and Papagena are Jack and Bella, who are the practical ones, the ones that just go about the business of living and get on with it. And we'll have a lovely suburban family of 2.5 children, and you know. And Mark and Jennifer need to find other things, the kind of spiritual component. But of course, it's magic flute, Frauen Schatten seen through Jungian eyes. So you have a lot of Jungian imagery. You've got the he and the she ancients, who are the equivalent of Jung's archetypes, I suppose. And it is about what is often with Michael Tippett's music. Child of Our Time has the same thing when in the last chorus the text goes, I would know my shadow and my light, so shall I at last be whole. So it's this reconciling the animus and the anima in our own psyches that is what the piece is about.
Sir Andrew Davis, who was also saying earlier that while Mozart's influence in the structure and characters of the Midsummer Marriage is obvious, he doesn't find much that's Mozartian about the music itself, aside from, well, the Mozartian dimensions of the orchestra and the key colours of flute, celesta and bassoon. So much of the music is from the English pastoral tradition, he thinks. Tippett luxuriating in descriptions of the ancient temple on a hilltop and the magical wood that surrounds it. And the writing for the chorus is fantastic, he thinks, as we're about to hear at the start of the third act, because they've been celebrating the end of Midsummer's Day with feasting and drinking, and they've plied one of their number with a little more drink than is good for his dancing. As the moon, the white goddess, soars into the sky, the girls wonder what Midsummer's night holds for them, while the men reveal that King Fisher has summoned them. For victory, comes his voice. He's determined to out-magic the ancients in the temple to win back his daughter, Jennifer. And he summons his own clairvoyant, Madame Sesostris, the voice we heard from behind the gates in the opera's first act. A procession brings a masked figure holding a crystal bowl in front of its face. It's Bella's sweetheart, Jack. He's about to become the sorcerer's apprentice. A gong and bells herald the arrival of the mysterious, black-veiled figure of Madame Sesostris, and Jack places the crystal bowl beside her. She's sung by mezzo Catherine Wynne Rogers, standing between the bust of Henry Wood and the Albert Hall's organ console. And Tippett gives her a deep, slow, rich orchestral sound, bassoons, trombones, cellos and basses. She's reminiscent of Zarastro in Mozart's Magic Flute. And she tells us she's the medium, not the message, and truth will shine through her. Jack hands her the bowl, and Tippett provides a beautiful bed of muted strings as Madame Sesostris sees a vision of a girl in a meadow opening her body to the sun like a flower, and then to a winged lion rampant with human face and the arms of a manly youth. "Mark!" cries a horrified King Fisher, who seizes the bowl and hurls it away. "It must be a hoax," he says. But the soothsayer stays silent, and King Fisher instructs Bella to fetch a pistol, holster and belt and give them to Jack. Jack is ordered to unveil Madame Sesostris, but he refuses, standing firm with Bella and throwing the belt at King Fisher's feet. He straps it on himself and thrusts his way through the chorus to unveil the clairvoyant, but as he reaches the last veil, a glow from beneath it increases in intensity, and a womb-like shape is revealed, a giant incandescent lotus bud. The petals open to reveal the lovers, Mark and Jennifer, entwined in red and gold, transfigured. King Fisher brandishes the pistol, but then clutches his heart and falls to the ground. The men carry his body into the temple while the she-ancient pronounces a blessing on the dead. And then comes Tippett's fourth ritual dance, Fire in Summer, as the dancers kindle flames in front of Mark and Jennifer, flickering strings, wind and brass. The lotus petals close around them. Carnal lust is transfigured as divine consuming love. And once the flames and smoke have vanished, we're left with moonlight on the pale stones of the temple as the chorus wonders whether it was all a dream. Where are the midsummer bride and groom? As we hear the first stirrings of the dawn chorus, the temple buildings disappear and Mark and Jennifer arrive from opposite sides of the stage, dressed for their wedding in this magic wood on Midsummer Day. Mark is sung by Paul Groves, Jennifer by Erin Wall, King Fisher by David Wilson-Johnson, and here's Sir Andrew Davis to conduct the BBC Symphony Orchestra in the last act of Tippett's The Midsummer Marriage. The sun has set its midsummer night, and the chorus has been eating, drinking, and dancing.
Surely you're not wanting them again.
Indeed, why not? Please go at once.
accept my challenge? Lifted to such lofty heights, I do.
So sorcery is all the story, for she reads the past and future like a book. My only child and daughter Jennifer's been kidnapped by these wicked people, locked away behind those gates. They pass musters of prevarication, deny they hold her, but they do. To make my way by force, for they can call upon a natural power. Therefore, I call on you to use your visionary powers to see my daughter where she is. That I, sustained by your device, may go to succor her and set her free. You have no cause to fear their force. I have no moral need to blench. A father may protect his child. Begin the contest. Examine first the picture in the hall, that I may see. Fine! Speak with Jennifer!
Yeah.
And there's danger. We must warn her. This is fearful to be so near and far.
The lion has reached the Osierbed, where she has gone to lie at length.
Oh, and disgusting trick. See then what happens to a lie. Sosostris, Sosostris, speak the truth.
Song is never spoken twice.
Sosostris. But does the truth perhaps hurt you? Are you dumb? You'll change your heart again. Here, take this belt and holster. Buckle it fast and so prepare to do what I command you.
Oh, Jack, why did I trust myself and not trust you? There in the shadow of the woods.
I can't undo this thing. You must help me.
Sosostris will not speak. Then I must speak. Since Sosostris will not act, then I must act.
Oh. Thank you.
A radiant ending to a miraculous score. You've just heard Sir Michael Tippett's opera, The Midsummer Marriage, first performed at the Royal Opera House in January 1955, and over half a century on, here at the BBC Proms tonight, as the centrepiece of this season's focus on Tippett's music. The BBC Singers, BBC Symphony Chorus, and BBC Symphony Orchestra were conducted by Sir Andrew Davis, whose love for this radiant, luxurious work, as he called it earlier, shone through every beat. But it's not Sir Andrew Davis who's come back onto the platform right now. It's chorus master Stephen Jackson, who was also our offstage conductor tonight. And a huge cheer from everyone here in the Royal Albert Hall for the combined forces of the singers. Wonderful chorus parts, as Andy Davis was telling us earlier. Very demanding. Stephen Jackson bowing to the audience and standing waiting for the arrival of this evening's soloists. The Tippett wove his own unique magic around characters borrowed from The Magic Flute, Shakespeare's A Midsummer Night's Dream and T.S. Eliot's The Wasteland. Here they are. First, the He Ancient and She Ancient, who kept popping up with the dancers from inside the temple, sung by David Saw and Madeline Shaw. And those cheers for Madame Sesostris, Catherine Wynne Rogers, her name taken from T.S. Eliot's The Wasteland. That's our common couple, although so beautifully brought to life it hardly seems fair to call them that. Bella, sung by Eilish Tynan, and Jack the Handyman, sung by Alan Clayton, the Papageno and Papagena of the show. And following in the footsteps, though thankfully not the stratospheric coloratura of Mozart's Queen of the Night, was Tippett's King Fisher, doing his best to derail the wedding, impressively sung by baritone David Wilson Johnson. He may have been a stand-in for the indisposed Peter Sidon, but he brings more experience of Tippett's music to the table, I think, than any other member of the cast. And finally, our royal couple, if you like, Mark and Jennifer, sung by Paul Groves and Erin Wall, the equivalents of Tamino and Pamina in Mozart's Magic Flute. And back comes the BBC Symphony Orchestra's conductor laureate, Sir Andrew Davis, blowing kisses to the orchestra and chorus, shaking hands with everyone he can reach at the front of the orchestra, not least leader Stephen Bryant, whose solos you heard at least a couple of times in the last act of the opera. All our soloists and conductor lined up, bowing to the audience here. And we should mention the stage director at the Royal Albert Hall, Kenneth Richardson, and the half-tipsy man and dancing man at the start of the third act was sung by Michael Bundy and Christopher Bowen. Well, if that's awakened an urge to hear more Tippett, then I'll point you towards this coming Tuesday's prom, the one that was to have been conducted by the late Sir Colin Davis. Meanwhile, tomorrow afternoon sees the arrival of Andris Nelson's and the City of Birmingham Symphony Orchestra for Dvorak's 8th Symphony. That's at 3 o'clock. But here in the Royal Albert Hall, we've had a midsummer marriage that I think will be remembered for a long time. When I left after Thursday's run-through of the opera, the sound of wedding bells was ringing out from a church just behind the Royal Albert Hall, a lovely piece of serendipity. I doubt they'll have managed to arrange it for this time of night, but, well, let's hope this is the start of a honeymoon period for Tippett's music. Well, let's see if we can find a best man. Back in Broadcasting House, here's James Jolly.
Thanks, Andrew. That was Andrew McGregor at the Royal Albert Hall. And there's another chance to hear tonight's prom on Tuesday afternoon at 2 o'clock here on BBC Radio 3. And don't forget that every prom is available for 7 days via the Radio 3 website. Now, at 10.25, we've another programme focusing on our BBC New Generation Artists and a performance by the Apollon Musagette Quartet of Goretzky's First String Quartet. So until then, I thought we'd have some chamber music by Handel. Hear from his Opus 1 set, a collection not without controversy and confusion, as two publications did the rounds with this opus number, is a sonata for violin. It's in E major, and it's his Opus 1 number 12. It's played by the Academy of Ancient Music. Handel's Violin Sonata in E, Opus 1, Number 12. The soloist was Pavlo Beznosyuk with Richard Egar, both members of the Academy of Ancient Music. Next, a couple of madrigals by Luca Marenzio, born almost exactly 100 years before Handel. First, Sweet Lady, I Give Thanks to Cupid, a hymn to a beautiful shepherdess. And then, I Will Leave You, Alas, My Heart is Failing, and the only cure can come from Cupid. Here's La Compagnia del Madrigale.
Thank you.
Two madrigals by Luca Marenzio from his first book of madrigals, published in Venice in 1580. Cantava la più vaga pastorella and then Partirò dunque. They were sung by La Compagnia della Madrigale.
Hi there, lovely listener. D-Love here and ready to share the love for digital radio on BBC Radio 3. Did you know that switching stations on a digital radio couldn't be easier? There's no fiddly tuning. It's all at the touch of a button. It's as smooth as listening to the sound of Mozart's 39th Symphony. And that's pretty smooth. So tell your friends, tell your family, share the love.
If you love radio, go digital. For more information on switching to digital radio and on coverage in your area, search online for BBC Digital Radio.
This is BBC Radio 3, 90 to 93 FM on digital radio and online. It's time now for another programme featuring some of the best young musical talent around. It's presented by Clemency Burton Hill.
Welcome back to New Generation Artists, the eighth programme in our 10-part series this summer, showcasing the really remarkable talents of the performers we have on the NGA scheme. Tonight's programme contains just one work, Gorecki's String Quartet No. 1, as performed by the Apollon Musagette Quartet. They formed just 5 years ago and are already making huge waves on the international chamber music scene. They're on their first year of the NGA scheme and have got some very exciting things coming up, including a new disc for Decca and a live Wigmore Hall recital in October, in which they'll be playing Mendelssohn and Shostakovich. Tonight, though, it's all about the Polish composer Henryk Gorecki and his extraordinary string quartet No. 1, subtitled Already It Is Dusk. It's based on the Polish Renaissance motet, a prayer for children going to sleep, with poetry by Wacław Szamafui. Already dusk is falling, night closes in. Let us beseech the Lord for help to be our guardian, to protect us from wicked devils who, especially under cover of darkness, profit from their cunning. Well, protecting us from those wicked devils, here are the Apollon Musagette Quartet to perform Gorecki's String Quartet No. 1. the Apollon Musagete Quartet, performing Gorecki's String Quartet No. 1, Already It Is Dusk. If you're interested in the ensemble and their fellow NGAs, do search online for BBC New Generation Artists or check out our Facebook page where you'll find lots of interviews and videos of the artists performing. Meanwhile, I'll be back on Sunday with another jam-packed NGA special featuring pianist Christian Ila Hadland, mezzo Jennifer Johnston and the Signum Quartet with all sorts of delights from Mozart to Hindemith. I hope you'll be able to join me then.
Clemency Burton Hill, and Sunday's programme begins at 5 o'clock. And talking of artists of the younger generation, the Norwegian trumpeter Tina Ting-Helseth is one of the soloists in Matthias Pincher's Chute d'Etoiles, which will be receiving its London premiere in Sunday evening's prom with the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra. And on Monday lunchtime, the tenor Robin Trichler, another of the current crop of BBC New Generation artists, will be joining the London Concord Ensemble for Peter Warlock's The Curlew. That's the chamber music prom live from Cadogan Hall on Monday at 1 o'clock.
This year, Radio 3's World Roots Academy has focused on the remarkable and little-known musical culture of Azerbaijan. Join me, Lucy Duran, at the BBC Proms as our Academy protégé, the young singer Fidan Hajiyeva.